The annual Gadget Fest in Las Vegas is in full swing. It's the Consumer Electronics Show, or CES, where technology companies show off their latest TVs, computers, cell phones, and other tech wizardry. NPR's Laura Seidel joins me from Las Vegas to talk about some of this year's highlights. And Laura, what was your favorite this year?
Blio. It's an ebook software, and I have to say it was just lovely. So it comes out next month, and you'll be able to access more than 1 million books on it. And what's so great is that, unlike some of the other ebook software you see out there, this one is color, it's interactive. So great for children's books. They showed us The Three Little Pigs, and that was pretty wonderful. Great for textbooks. So if you had an anatomy book and you were a medical student, it has interactive quizzes in the book. So it has all this nice stuff. I really loved it. It was one of my favorite things here.
And just to be clear, the Blio is actually software. It's not a physical object.
Exactly. It's software. So you would read it on one of these various devices.
So would Blio have the same kind of access to book titles as Amazon does, or with the Kindle?
It has different access to different books and about 1 million free books. And you can read them on laptops, PCs, netbooks, certain e-readers. And you can read them perhaps on what's one of the biggest categories here, tablet computers. It's a kind of interesting category. And there's been a lot of buzz about them, although most people probably don't know what I'm talking about at this point.
Yeah, I know. I don't know what you're talking about.
A tablet computer, in its most basic form, it's a computer without the keyboard. And it didn't do well when it was first introduced in a big way about 10 years ago, but the technology's gotten better. In this day and age, it would basically be kind of a combination ebook, film watching device, music device. It would let you email, and you could use a stylus to actually write on it. And so instead of carrying all those different things, you could carry it in one thing, and that's a tablet PC.
Okay, well, that sounds very appealing. What other hot stuff did you see this year?
Well, I have a pair of 3D glasses in my pocket.
just in case the world becomes 3D?
3D technology is really big. You know, the film studios are behind it, the television networks, the hardware makers. ESPN has said they're actually going to start broadcasting some games in 3D. And they are hoping that 3D will be the hope of the future for the film industry and the television industry. Everybody's banking a lot on this, and so it is everywhere. I don't know if people are going to want to pay all that money, since they just laid out all that money for HDTV, but it is pretty cool to look at.
Well, anything else you saw that was especially fun or surprising?
How about this? A TV that watches you back.
Yipes.
So this television could actually see where your head was. And if you were on one side of the room, it would direct the audio towards you in that direction. Also, if you're like a short person, as in a kid, and you walk really close to it, the screen will talk back to you and it'll say, move away from the screen.
All right. NPR's Laura Seidel at the Consumer Electronics Show, where she's watching TVs and TVs are watching her. Thanks, Laura.
You're welcome.
Many of us these days spend time online at social networking sites, Facebook, say, or MySpace or LinkedIn. And if you use those sites, you know how easy it is to happily fritter away hours in the Twitterverse or some other online community. But what happens if you get sick of all those messages on your Facebook wall? Well, the brains behind a website called Web 2.0 Suicide Machine offer this encouragement to end it all. Virtually.
It doesn't make your life better. You always think you're missing something. And above all, it makes you more stupid.
Gordon Savicich is the CEO, which he says stands for Chief Euthanasia Officer of SuicideMachine.org. He joins us on the phone from Vienna. And tell me, the idea here is what? To abandon your virtual life so you can get your actual life back?
Well, that was certainly one of our intentions. Basically, we try to remove as much content as possible. We change the profile picture and the password so you can't log in anymore.
So what happens if I were to go log into suicidemachine.org? Mm-hmm. What do I see? How does it work?
What happens is you click commit, and then you see
click commit.
A pop-up.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. There you see basically a remote desktop session. So you see how a web browser is being started. And then, depending on the service you chose, you will see that the machine logs into your account. You see your friend list, and then basically the machine starts, based on our scripts, to remove the friend connections of everyone. Or in case of Twitter, we remove the followers and the people you follow. Changes your profile picture, changes your password, and finally it logs out.
So one by one, deleting your friends online, you watch them disappear.
You can take time and relax in front of the computer and see how your 2.0 life is passing away.
What happens if you change your mind halfway through?
That's a problem.
That's a problem.
Because we can't stop it, and also the process.
Well, have you had a lot of interest? How many people have signed up?
We have around 900 users. And since last Sunday, Facebook blocked our service.
Facebook has blocked your service.
They basically didn't like the idea that we are unfriending other people's accounts. And we still have to decide how we react on that.
That's Gordon Savicich from suicidemachine.org, which will help you commit social media suicide. It's the idea of a group called Modder. That's a bunch of artists, designers, and programmers based in Rotterdam. Facebook released a statement earlier this week saying Suicide Machine violates their rules of user interaction. The company says it is, quote, currently investigating and considering whether to take further action. This is NPR News. Cities are the largest emitters of ozone, the main ingredient in smog. And across the nation, urban areas have been the ones struggling to meet air quality standards, while rural counties, which emit less ozone, have generally remained below smog pollution limits. But soon, that may no longer be the case. The Environmental Protection Agency this week proposed a tighter ozone pollution standard, and now many suburban and rural areas may be running into trouble with the feds. David Gorn has this report.
Some of the worst air pollution in the nation is in California. In fact, Los Angeles, Sacramento, and Fresno consistently rank in the top 10 of the most polluted cities in the U.S. But if you go up to the far north of the state, in the mountains of Siskiyou County, near the Oregon border, the skies are clearer, but maybe not clear enough.
I don't think we've got the industrial activity and or the population appear to really create a bad situation as far as ozone goes.
That's Eldon Beck. He's sitting in his small air pollution control office up in the town of Yreka. Beck says it's a small operation up here, just him and his boss, who also doubles as the county ag commissioner and the animal control officer. And Beck says he can't quite believe his county may soon be out of compliance with proposed new federal ozone standards.
Well, we're not very excited about that at all.
The current federal limit for ozone is 75 parts per billion. But the new plan is tougher, putting the ozone threshold at between 60 and 70 parts per billion. And that could send many more counties into noncompliance, which could eventually mean the loss of federal dollars, such as highway funding. This comes at a time when many suburban and rural counties are facing budget shortfalls, and many are worried about more expense in a bad economy. But for Melissa Kelly Ortega, living in the town of Merced, at the northern lip of the Central Valley, it might mean that her six-year-old can breathe a little easier.
The valley is actually like a bowl, so our pollution just sits here. In the summertime, what we're dealing with is ozone and smog, and that's really a bunch of different types of pollutants, but then they're cooked by the sun, and so we're kind of sitting in this big pot of pollution soup.
Ortega says her daughter has severe asthma because of it. Asthma and other respiratory diseases have increased as smog pollution levels have risen, says Janice Nolan of the American Lung Association. Sometimes people think of these ailments as mildly inconvenient, but she says they're much more of a health threat than that.
There are actually people who die from asthma. This is the kind of thing where children are turning blue and they end up in the emergency room at night.
But keeping pollutants out of the air is not a simple task. For one thing, smog travels. So, for instance, San Francisco, with its sea breezes, is far below the ozone emission threshold, but its smog blows east into Sacramento, where the terrain bottles up that smog into the Sacramento Valley. Up in Siskiyou County, Eldon Beck says some of their pollution is from forest fires, and some of it likely comes from the nearby city of Medford. So what is cash-strapped Siskiyou supposed to do about that?
It's somehow we're going to have to develop a plan, I guess, to try to come into compliance. But it's going to be a big expense all the way around.
Just how stringent the new regulation will be is up for discussion. A series of public meetings will be held this year, in part to decide what ozone level is fair as well as safe. For NPR News, I'm David Gorn.
Did you watch the Liberty Bowl about a week ago?
I saw so many bowl games, I'm not even sure.
Well, did you see that computerized coin toss at the beginning?
I did see that.
So do you know what was up with that, Kevin?
I sure don't.
I do.
Travis Larchuk, one of our producers here on the program, you had the answer.
Yes, and I think that this could be one of the biggest innovations in sports technology of the decade, by which I mean from 2001 to 2010.
You mean from 2000 to 2009?
No, the real decade.
Okay, so describe this for people who did not see the Liberty Bowl.
Right, so every football game begins with a coin toss, and whichever team wins it gets to decide who kicks off first. But watching the coin toss is boring.
We're seeing six little people very far away doing something in the center of the field, and we can hear the ref talking about it, but we cannot see it.
All right, so that's Dan LaRue. Mm-hmm. He's an inventor, and he saw this problem, and he came up with a solution.
A solution.
Yeah, so have you ever played the Nintendo Wii? You swing a plastic controller around, and you're pretending to play tennis on TV?
No.
But you know about it.
Yeah.
So it works kind of like that, except you take the technology that makes the Wii controller work, and you put it into the referee's coin.
When the ref tosses the coin, there's data coming from that coin to a computer. The computer calculates the height and the spin rate of the coin and projects that on the display using computer graphics.
Okay, I'm not sure I got all that.
Well, I'll demonstrate. Let me empty out my change purse.
You carry a change purse?
Don't judge me, guy. You see this quarter that I'm holding up right now?
Yep.
All right, now say we're on the field at the Liberty Bowl. I'm the ref. Now, as I move this quarter around, there's a 3D virtual coin up there on the Jumbotron that's moving in the exact same way that my coin is.
So as your coin is spinning through the air, I can watch the computer version in real time flipping on the Jumbotron.
Exactly, and you can even see which side the coin lands on before the ref does.
This is ridiculous. Why would anybody ever invent this?
Well, it's the age-old story, guy. If you can get everyone in the stadium's eyes glued up there on the Jumbotron during the coin toss, you could put an ad up there and make some money.
Of course. That's one of our producers, Travis Larchuk. Travis, thanks.
No problem, guy.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. The Consumer Electronics Show wraps up this weekend in Las Vegas. That's where some of the world's coolest gadgets have made their debut over the years. Remember Pong on Atari? That was unveiled at CES in 1975, and we've come a long way since then. 3D television, tablet computers, cars we can talk to. NPR's Laura Seidel was at the show in Las Vegas, and she joins us to fill us in on the exciting products from this year's show. Welcome, Laura.
Nice to be here.
Does that sound of Pong take you back?
I'm not old enough to remember. I'm just kidding.
Stop. But I'll tell you what I'm not ready for is 3D television.
Yes, yep. 3D televisions. They're there, and the glasses along with them, and there were a lot of them this year at CES. Everybody's putting out a 3D television. And, of course, there is content that's coming out for 3D. Sony, Discovery, and IMAX have teamed up. They're going to create a channel with just 3D content. ESPN is going to put out about 85 games starting this year in June. They're going to start with the World Cup, and they're going to have that in 3D. And there were lots of TVs to watch them on. And it was pretty lovely stuff, I have to say.
Really? You liked it? It worked for you?
It does work in a certain way. Although I have to admit, I walked by a poster promoting it, and you saw these families all sitting around with their 3D glasses, and it looked odd.
Like those old photos from the magazines of the 50s, right?
Yeah, it just looked odd. You know, I somebody joked, you know, 3D is the technology of the future, and it always will be. You know, we've been talking about it a long time, really, since Pong, right?
Really?
You know, think about how long we've been talking about 3D, but the technology's come a long way. The entire industry is behind it. They're pushing it. Now, I have to say, as to whether or not it's going to happen as fast as they think it is, I'm skeptical.
Computers, Sony and HP, others unveiled their version of something called the tablet. Not a phone, not a laptop. What is it?
Okay, briefest description would probably be it's a laptop without a keyboard. With the latest versions, or some of the versions I've seen, you can use a stylus like a pen, so you could actually write into it. You can carry your movies, your books. And I want to say, even though there were a lot of e-book readers on the floor, I think what we're really evolving to eventually is tablet computers. So the e-book is a transition phase.
How soon will we see that?
Well, we're going to start seeing them very soon. But here's the big news that was looming over CES. The end of the month, Apple is expected to announce a tablet computer. There are a lot of rumors about it. I believe when there's this many rumors that Apple's going to do something, it's usually true. And everybody's waiting to see, because Apple has this tendency to really push everything forward and create these beautiful devices. I mean, think about the iPod and the iPhone, right?
Speaking of an iPhone, was there really a helicopter drone that one company's making and it can be remote controlled using an iPhone?
Yes! It's made by this French company called Parrot, and you can control it with an iPhone, and it kind of floats and hovers. And I think the idea is that you might be able to develop games for it. So, you know, kind of games that would be both computerized games and real-world games. Go searching for clues with your own personal drone.
Wow. Lots of announcements about getting internet in cars, voice-activated systems. Can I ask you about Magic Jack 2.0? This is a device, a little gadget. It's going to sell.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean,
yes.
Actually, it's something that the cell carriers are protesting because it's using radio waves without permission, right?
Yes, that's right. Well, Magic Jack's been out, and there's been about 5 million people who've purchased the previous Magic Jack, which basically lets you make internet phone calls on your computer. What the key here is that this one will actually, if you have your cell phone in the house, it will connect to your cell phone and you'll be able to make free cell phone calls. That would actually use the radio waves that these carriers have spent a lot of money to buy. And so that is why they're protesting. The people who make it say, well, you don't own the waves that are actually in somebody's house, and this is just for making free cell phone calls in the house, but it could save people a lot of money. These tech battles sometimes over who owns the airwaves can go on for a long time.
Finally, did you see the Google phone?
Yes, I have, and I liked it. People keep asking, is it an iPhone killer? I don't know if it's an iPhone killer, but it moves quickly. I found the battery life to be longer than the iPhone, and I definitely found it to be something that was comparable to an iPhone. I really liked using it.
And the Google phone is called the Nexus One?
That is correct.
NPR's Laura Seidel was at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas this past week. Laura, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
As Google unveiled the Nexus One, another tech giant was making a big move. Apple paid nearly $300 million for mobile advertising company Quattro Wireless. This comes on the heels of Google's $800 million acquisition of AdMob in November. Gene Munster is a research analyst for the investment firm Piper Jaffray, and he joins us from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Is it my imagination, or is the stage being set for some kind of epic battle between Apple and Google? What's happening?
Well, it basically was a declaration of war from Google when they announced the Nexus One phone. And you're exactly right. The battleground is over advertising and really this explosive growth that's going to happen the next 10 years with mobile devices. And so two smart companies here, both Apple and Google, who realize the opportunity and the potential, and I think that's a great way to say it. It's going to be a battle.
What's the opportunity for Apple, briefly?
The opportunity is this advertising market, in terms of the Quattro acquisition specifically, is that essentially what they want to do is create an environment where it's easy for app developers to make money. 80% of the apps that are downloaded from iTunes are for free, and basically what Quattro will do is help those app developers make money easily.
And what does Google get out of acquiring AdMob?
Well, Google gets the same. They want to have an easy platform, just like Apple, for their developers that make their apps to make money as well off those free applications. And so essentially Apple and Google have the exact same intentions in their acquisitions of AdMob and Quattro.
So mobile ads are coming, and there's something that's called location-based advertising. How does that work? I mean, what would happen if I had, one of these phones?
Well, it's an advertiser's dream, and essentially what happens is there's a lot of information that an advertiser has or the network has just by you having one of these smartphones. As you're walking down the street, they know your exact location. They know your gender, your age, because you signed up for a plan. They also will know the time of day and so in some of your history searching habits in the past. And so essentially these devices will be able to zap ads to you as you're walking down the street that may be, for example, an ad for a coupon for a dinner that might be around the corner. But that potential, and that's just scratching the surface, is massive.
Yeah. I mean, the iPhones already have the maps that feature, if you type restaurant and it shows pushpins. But this is an actual ad that I'll get if I'm near the restaurant and they want to advertise to me?
Exactly. That they could just present an ad to you, even though you might not even do a query.
It's going to annoy people, Do you think?
It will.
I mean, think how pop-up ads have really begun to annoy.
Yeah, we think there's going to be, to that point, this secondary effect of essentially a lot of these free apps right now don't have advertising, and they'll have a lot of advertising that's going to get annoying. But then you'll have a pay-for option for $2 or $3 that get rid of the ads. So $2 and let me be.
Did it surprise you that Apple got into the advertising business?
It was a surprise. I mean, it's a historical day, the day that Google gets into the hardware business, Apple gets into the advertising business, and this war begins. If you think about the next 10 years of computing and the mobile opportunity and the impressions that are being created, and you step back, it does make a lot of sense that Apple gets in the advertising market, because an impression basically is a page view. An impression equals an opportunity to an advertiser. There's a lot of money that's going to be able to made off of advertising with all these impressions.
Let's talk about that money. I mean, at your firm, Piper Jaffray, both Apple and Google are important to your investors. How do you see the battle between these two giants from an investment point of view?
Well, there are two ways to think about this. I mean, we think of Apple as more of a hunter and Google as more of a farmer. Apple is hunting for the next best technology, and their really advantage is to have something cool and hot that people are going to want to buy on a month-to-month basis. Google has a much different approach. They're very long-term focused. They really want to build a platform and really try to extend their reach from search and other advertising. So from an investment standpoint, we think Apple is a great opportunity in the next year just because they have so many exciting products, including the tablet, which we believe will be out in the next couple months. And from Google's perspective, it's a much safer, longer-term bet.
Gene Munster is a research analyst for Piper Jaffray. He joined us from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. Thanks so much.
Thank you.